What is up, thou rags, thou quantities, thou remnants? Welcome to No Holds Barred, the Shakespeare podcast Shakespeare would have listened to. I'm Dan Bollier.
And I'm Kevin Condardo. We are here with our monthly installment of So You're Going to See Shakespeare, which the idea of this episode is that it's something you'll listen to in transit to a Shakespearean production so that we can prepare you to be the best little audience member that you can be.
An audio version of the dramaturgical notes, if you will.
So, hopefully you'll enjoy this episode as this month you head out to see The Taming of the Shrew.
Here we go.
The first thing we need to cover before we get into this episode is a quick synopsis of the play so you at least know the story. Daniel,
yeah.
Would you like to kick us off?
Absolutely. So this is one of Shakespeare's rare plays that begins with an induction in which we meet Christopher Sly, some servants, and some lords who basically happen upon a drunk man in the street and are like, you know what? How about we mess with this guy and convince him he's a lord and then we'll do a play for him. So they're like, okay, let's do that. And he wakes up, and he's like, I'm not a lord. And like, yes, you are, sir. We brought a whole play to check out this play we made for you. It's called The Taming of the Shrew.
And so then he sits down, and then we get to Act 1, Scene 1. So we basically, we're here in Padua, and we have Lucentio, Gremio, and Hortensio are three young men who want to marry Baptista, a local lord's youngest daughter, Bianca. But Baptista says, you can't marry her until my eldest daughter, Katharina, is married. And no one is really interested in taking up that offer, so they basically are going to spend the rest of the play scheming on how to get around that.
Right. So they say, let's join up, and we can try to find someone who can marry her. But in the meantime, let's be ready to marry Bianca when we can. So Lucentio gets his servant Tranio, and they say, why don't we switch gigs? Tranio, you'll be Lucentio, and I'll be this guy called Cambio, and I will basically seduce my way into Bianca's world as a tutor. I can be her music tutor. So, like, that's a good idea.
That works. So then, meanwhile, Hortensio's plan is he gets his old buddy Petruchio, who is traveling with his servant Grumio, says, hey, there's this girl in town that's amazing. You should totally marry her. Her name's Katharina. I think you'd hit it right off. And Petruchio's like, mm-hmm. And he's like, well, she's a little ill-tempered, we'll say. And Petruchio says, yeah, all right. I know Baptista, who's Catherine's dad. Introduce me and let's see how this goes.
So that brings us to Act 2, Scene 1. So we meet Kate. We actually get to meet the shrew we've heard so much about. And she's basically beating up her younger sister, Bianca. And then Baptista comes in and is like, what are you doing? Stop this. So at this point, all the gentlemen come in and they're like, I heard you have, Petruchio's like, I heard you have a very nice daughter. She's fair and virtuous. And he's like, well, I have a daughter. So he's like, give her to me. I want to meet her. And they're like, you really don't want to do this. I don't think this is the best idea. And he's like, listen, that's why I'm here. Bring her in. So then we have the amazing scene with Petruchio and Kate, which is one of those, it's Benedict and Beatrice, sort of a Jace, but it's also a knockout. It's like, it's Act 2, Scene 1, and it's borderline climax of the play.
Mm-hmm. So, now beginning the denouement with Act 3, Scene 1, apparently. Hortensio and Lucentio have both jumped in on this tutoring train. Lucentio is teaching Latin. Lucentio, who is pretending to be Cambio, try and keep up. There will be a test.
I will fail this test.
Meanwhile, while Tranio is playing Lucentio, in any case, Lucentio is doing much better with Bianca than Hortensio is, and Hortensio is not really thrilled, and he sees this coming down the highway that he's playing uphill from here on out.
Yeah, so this is the wedding day. Kate, it's up for debate, but whether or not she wants to be there, she is there. And then what do you know? They're all like, he's not coming. He's supposed to be here, and Petruchio's not here. And then the guy walks in, his servant runs in, he's like, I have some news. Petruchio's on his way, but he looks real weird. He's dressed up like a crazy person. He walks in. He basically takes Kate, and he's like, we're married now, and I'm getting out of here. And she's like, can we stay and have the party? And he's like, you're coming with me. And everyone freaks out, and she basically is devastated, and he takes her off and brings her back to his home.
Right, and so then the next scene, we see Grumio arriving at Petruchio's house ahead of Petruchio and Kate, and he's freaking out at all of Petruchio's servants, saying how Petruchio's just been bullying Kate, like she fell off her horse and he didn't help. And then Petruchio shows up and he bullies around all the servants. And then he says the food's terrible. He's basically like now moving Kate the Shrew into like a hostage situation.
Yeah.
Takes her up to the bed, takes her up, puts her to bed, locks her in the bedroom, and then tells Grumio that he's going to keep her from sleeping that night, saying that he's going, you know, he's basically treating her like the way you train a falcon.
Exactly. Exactly. So then we cut back to Tranio and Hortensio and Bianca, and they are continuing the pursuit of Bianca's love. Now that Kate is married, that there is a possibility for this to actually work out.
So then Tranio and Hortensio see that Lucentio and Bianca are like snuggling up on each other. So they both are like, nope, we're good. You know what? Lucentio took this one. Let's go figure out other things to do.
Right. So Hortensio, he marries this old lady.
Yeah.
Who's just an old widow. And he's happy there.
And then Biondello finds an old man to...
They trick an old guy. Don't trick him. They ask him, well, you know, will you play the part of Lucentio's father, Vincentio, so that Baptista will marry off... Because Baptista needs to know that there's a dowry involved here.
Right, sure.
And that there's some wealth happening coming his way. So like, hey, old guy, will you pretend to be my dad, Vincentio, and say, yes, I do in fact have all this money so that I can marry Bianca.
Yes.
Great. So then Kate and Petruchio are coming back to Padua, and on the way, they meet an old man who happens to actually be Vincentio. And they're like, oh, what? You should come with us. We're heading back to Padua. What's the worst that could possibly happen if we all go to the same place?
What could possibly go wrong? Then Tranio and this person dressed up as Vincentio arrive at Baptista's house. This random old dude says that, yeah, sure, this wedding sounds great. And then Lucentio says, all right, we're good, let's go. And he goes off to suggest to Bianca that they just sneak off and get married.
So then what happens is Vincentio, who comes in, is about to be arrested. And then Lucentio sees that his actual father is about to be arrested and has to reveal, hey, wait a minute, I'm not Cambio. Tranio's not Lucentio. I'm Lucentio. Vincentio, that's actually Vincentio. The other person who we think is Vincentio is not Vincentio, of course. And this is all of our costumes have come off, and the parents are like, well, you can still get married.
Everybody's following this, right?
Yep.
Okay, great. So now we sneak off to the church. We have all these weddings. And so we have our couples, Hortensio and the widow, Lucentio and Bianca, and Kate and Petruchio, and they were all married. And what's the bet that they make here?
Basically, they make a bet about whose wife will do the bidding the most readily, the most easily.
Mm-hmm. The three husbands.
Guys all make this wager. And they send for the widow first, and she's like, go pound sand. They send for Bianca, and she's like, no. And then they send for Kate, and she comes in. And everyone in the room is like, is this possible? This was the crazy shrew that no one could tame. And then she has, choose an adjective of your own choice, I suppose, this monologue about the role of a wife and the role of how she relates to her husband.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the end of the play.
And that, more or less, is the taming of the shrew. Now that you know generally what you'll be watching, we're going to take a few minutes to talk about where The Taming of the Shrew falls in Shakespeare's personal timeline and what was happening in the world when it was written. Daniel.
Yeah. So there's some speculation about what year this may have been written. For our sake, I'm going to focus in for a quick second here on 1591, which is one of the leading candidates, and just say that as in terms of what was going on in the world, I was looking up today what happened in 1591, and it's just a series of so-and-so occupied so-and-so, so-and-so conquered so-and-so, so-and-so surrendered to someone else. It's like this is all that happened this year was fighting and conquering. So it's kind of interesting that a play about conquering and occupying is being written at this time. But it's definitely early Shakespeare. We know that for sure.
Mm-hmm. There is some question that in terms of when this was actually written because there is a play titled The Taming of a Shrew, right?
Correct.
Right. The Taming of a Shrew by an anonymous author that shows up possibly earlier than 1591, before the Taming of the Shrew, by William, credited to William Shakespeare, shows up closer to 1594.
Yes.
But the loose use of that word, but switching between and the, makes it unclear whether Taming of a Shrew is the same play or just an inspiration.
Right. There was, I noticed, I read some speculation somewhere that on the title page of one, it mentions the Pembroke's men, who had gone off on tour during plague and came back to London a few months later completely. They just fell apart on tour. They were desolate. They were broke. The company just folded. And then there's some speculation that some of the actors may have penned some of the copies of that they had taken out the original.
Mm-hmm.
And they wrote copies of the script and sold it just to try to get any money because they were so desperate at the time.
Right.
Which is where that other text may have come from.
It's similar to the bad quarto Hamlet that it
Correct.
Could be. It's a parallel. And the fact that they were traveling through bars makes sense for the structure of this play that starts with a drunk at a bar.
Right, exactly. This was written for the road.
The other thing that I find interesting about the history of this play as a theater contract person,
yes,
is that you can track the copyright ownership of this play.
Oh, okay.
To a gentleman named John Smethwick, who bought a package in, I think this is in 1607, he bought four Shakespeare plays that he had ownership until the first folio was printed. His pack of four was Taming of the Shrew, Romeo and Juliet, Love's Labour's Lost, and Hamlet.
It's a pretty good deal.
Pretty decent four pack if you're gonna own four of the 38.
Right.
But there's an interesting, you know, talking about the consortium of people who actually owned the plays is interesting.
That's really neat. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
It's also kind of cool to think about. I was wondering today to myself, this is early Shakespeare, and we know this is written during Elizabeth's life and her own issues and her own sort of who she was as the most powerful woman in the world at the time, to have this play being written as by an early sort of upstart playwright probably got him on her radar for better or for worse. It's a bold move by Shakespeare as an early playwright to write this play, I think.
Absolutely. Then just one more piece, you know, this is, if he's writing it in 1591, 1592, this is kind of a transitionary point in English theater where it's going from, you know, the passion plays from like the 1560s to the 1590s to something that's more what we consider Elizabethan.
Yeah. Passion plays, you mean like morality plays?
Morality plays, that's what I meant, yeah.
Gotcha.
And so, like, for instance, this induction, this weird induction with Christopher Sly, I have the stat that from 1565 to 1592, 90% of printed plays had some kind of framing device, whether consisting of a dramatized scene without the play, or a prologue and or epilogue, or some combination of all three.
Interesting.
So this induction was a touch of something from a previous era that Shakespeare is bringing with him.
Cool.
So, yeah. All right. So, there you go. There's a little history of the play. Next up, we'll identify what we consider to be the most prominent theme in the play and particular places where you may see it come up. Dan has chosen his three favorites, and I'm going to pick my choice of those three for us to dig in on. So, Dan, what are our finalists for Miss Best Theme?
Taming of the Shrew is so wonderful because there are so many options here for Best Theme. So for this one, I want to throw a challenger away, Mr. Kevin. So here are the
crap.
Three themes I've chosen for us today. Class, Transformation, and Theatricality. Class, Transformation, and Theatricality.
I'll take Transformation.
Fantastic. So Transformation, places we might see this throughout the course of The Taming of the Shrew. What led you to this answer?
So when I was doing prep for this episode, it struck me that pretty much everyone in this play pretends to be someone else at some point.
Correct.
And as we stumbled through the synopsis, you can see how somewhat confusing it can get. So let alone direct intentional transformation from, you know, Tranio to Lucentio or Lucentio to Cambio. You also have, obviously, the transformation in Kate. Also, the transformation of Petruchio.
Absolutely.
You know, so I think there are a lot of ways we can attack this.
Yeah. I do think the play starts with a transformation where they they choose Christopher Sly in the induction, if your director has chosen to keep the induction, you will see the play begin by someone being told they are someone that they are not.
Mm-hmm.
And in this world, that person goes, well, okay, sure, let's go with that.
Yes, and.
Yes, and. So, you know, from the very, very beginning all the way to the very end, transformation runs rampant. And I think you're absolutely right, Kev. I think if this play, if Petruchio doesn't transform,
mm-hmm.
is horrible.
Right. I mean, we haven't really touched on the problems of the play as a whole in terms of, you know, misogyny.
This which is a heck of a time for that, I think.
Yes, which is, you know, it's something that if you play this straight with Kate just getting broken like a horse and Petruchio just being this, you know,
tyrant,
negging tyrant from, like, you know, playing the game or whatever, that's a horrible evening of theater that no one's going to enjoy, you know?
Correct. Correct.
That a very specific subset of people are going to enjoy. Whereas there is enough wiggle room, there's enough here that you can have a Kate and a Petruchio that actually have a real relationship and end up on the same side. And,
yeah.
you know, there's more depth to Kate's final monologue or their wooing.
Yeah.
And so that there does need to be a transformation of Petruchio and not just Kate going from spirited to broken.
Right. You know, that's still, she still is very spirited at the end. And that's just, you learn, and that's just sort of what growing up is, I suppose, at times where you just go, okay, sometimes you just have to do the thing you have to do, or you want to do the thing you want to do for someone else, because they've changed too, and they're in it together.
Right.
At the end, that makes for an interesting story. So you have characters that willingly change, willingly transform. You have characters that are transformed, or characters that are transformed against their will. Like mm-hmm. when you have Vincenzo, who's being told he's under arrest, and he's like, "I'm Vincenzo," and they're like, "No, you're not."
Mm-hmm.
Or Sly. Tranio, who gets to transform from a servant, not just transform characters, but transform
class. Yeah.
Goes from being the servant to, oh, I get to run the show, and has a lot of fun with that.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that's, I mean, I think we covered it. We just named everyone in the play, so I think we're good. So there you go. Transformation. Keep an eye out for it when you go out to see The Taming of the Shrew. In this section of the show, we choose which non-title characters we would most want to play in this piece and explain why in 2 minutes or less. Dan won the coin flip before the show.
Yeah.
And has elected to go first?
Yes.
All right, so go ahead.
Nice try.
Yeah, well.
Well, since the shrew is not available to me in this possible scenario,
mm-hmm.
I am going to go with, well, this is actually interesting. This is a character, I don't know if I've expressed this before on the pod, but for me, sometimes it's really just about, as an actor, being a conduit for a character.
Mm-hmm.
I have this belief that characters exist, like their spirit lives in the world, and as an actor, you just kind of channel them, let that spirit come through you. And for me, having once enacted this role before, I would like to do Petruchio again.
Okay.
And I will tell you why. He was miserable to live with. It was like, when that show closed, I was so happy to let that thing go.
Mm-hmm.
Petruchio is such a weird, and I don't know what that means. I've never had that experience before, and I played some weirdos. But Petruchio freaked me out. So I just
too close to home?
I think probably, honestly, yeah. Like, it was hard.
Mm-hmm.
But it was actually a very, very rewarding process, because going in with the intention of finding as much love as possible for mm-hmm. everyone in the play,
mm-hmm.
and that it's just someone who's a basket case, which I can relate to.
Yes, you can.
It made it really, really rewarding. So I would like to actually try that again, knowing what I'm in store, like knowing what's coming, and being a little bit more prepared for it, because it was terrifying. It was one of the more awkward experiences I've ever had as an actor.
That's fascinating, man.
Yeah, it was weird.
I'll give you the rare compliment on this podcast that I thought it was a wonderful performance. So there you go.
Oh, wow.
Yeah,
thank you.
That's the end of that. I'll see you in another 50 episodes with a compliment.
Wow. What to do?
For my 2 minutes, there are a lot of good. The nice thing about the undercard of this play, there are a lot of nice things to choose from. For a second, I thought about just taking Christopher Sly and punting, because then you get to drink for the last 2 hours and 45 minutes of the play, if not before.
Correct.
But I think the part that I enjoy in this play the most is Tranio, Lucentio's servant. It's just a great grip it and rip it, no downside, all upside role. It's an opportunity. It's like Oswald in King Lear.
Yep.
Is that right? Yeah.
Yeah.
That you just have a chance. You have a chance to steal the show, and if you just hit your marks, you're going to be fine.
Right.
You know, like it's a challenging part. You have to hit those marks.
Right.
But you can really go in there and steal every scene that you're in, if you have that good chemistry with everyone else that's going on in there. You just get to have fun, and then you know, you get out of there. So,
it's a great character. The character is having a blast.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Exactly, you know, and there, you know, the other guy, you know, if you have Hortensio or you have Lucentio, there's some heavy lifting in those guys that they have to do. Tranio just gets to take batting practice for this whole thing, and I think that would be a lot of fun to be a part of that ensemble.
You know, you have always struck me as a Tranio.
Thank you.
That's my compliment back to you.
That was very sweet.
It's a give and receive.
Something like that. So there you go. Those are our recommended roles for The Taming of the Shrew. This is the section of the show where we pull our favorite phrase from this play and talk through it so that you can nod smugly and knowingly when you hear it. The line we chose from The Taming of the Shrew is, "I'll buckler thee against a million," from Act 3, Scene 2. Let's hear the phrase in context. "Gentlemen, forward to the bridal dinner. I see a woman may be made a fool if she had not a spirit to resist."
"They shall go forward, Kate, at thy command. Obey the bride, you that attend on her. Go to the feast, revel and domineer, carouse full measure to her maidenhead, be mad and merry, or go hang yourselves. But for my bonny Kate, she must with me. Nay, look not big, nor stamp, nor stare, nor fret. I will be master of what is mine own. She is my goods, my chattels. She is my house, my household stuff, my field, my barn, my horse, my ox, my ass, my anything, and here she stands. Touch her, whoever dare. I'll bring mine action on the proudest he that stops my way in Padua. Fear not, sweet wench. They shall not touch thee, Kate. I'll buckler thee against a million."
So that was "I'll buckler thee against a million" from Act 3, Scene 2 of The Taming of the Shrew. Dan, you want to give us some context on this?
Yeah, sure. So this is post-wedding. Petruchio has rolled in like a crazy person after making her wait and thinking that she wasn't going to show up at all. They have the most horrific experience on this wedding day, and then they're like, let's go to the party at least and have some fun, and he's like, I have to go, and Tranio's like, no, you have to just stay for the dinner, and he's like, no, I can't. And then Gremio's like, come on, please, and he's like, no, I can't. And then Kate is like, please, and he's like, okay, I'm happy. And she's like, you're happy you're gonna stay? He's like, no, I'm happy that you want me to stay, but I can't. So then it's like, oh, this is brutal. Like, let's get out of here. And then she says, if you love me, stay. And he says, get my horse. And then she's, okay, you know what? So she tells him, you can get out of here. I'm staying. And he's like, no, don't do that. Don't be angry. And she's like, I am angry. You can't control me. And then she's saying, everyone, let's go. Let's go on to the dinner. And he's like, yes, everyone, obey her. Do what she says. She is in charge. Except not in charge. Kate, come with me. We're leaving. And then before she can even say anything, he basically tells her, no, don't freak out. And then he has this monologue where he talks to the people in the room and saying that this is who she is. She is everything that I have. Mm-hmm. And then he says, come on, let's go. If anyone wants to fight me on this, she's right here. Go ahead and take your chance. And then no one moves. And he's like, let's get out of here, Kate. Mm-hmm. I've got you now.
And she off they goes.
Go. Yep.
So I think this is a good example of how you could play this, you know, even the phrase, she is my goods, my chattels, she is my house, my household stuff, my field, my barn, my horse, my ox, my ass, my anything. You could play that one way, like she's a piece of property or an object.
Yeah.
But it's The way that I think that you could also read it, and is the more interesting way to read it, is she is my life. She is my everything.
Right.
It can be romantic, or it can be derogatory.
Yeah.
And one of those choices is much more interesting than the other in production.
I agree 100%. And that is a nice, also, this is one of those great reminders of the use of scansion. That if you look at it, the word my is never in a stressed position.
Mm-hmm.
It's always on the offbeat. And I think that's Shakespeare warning you against, don't play the my. You know,
it's mine. My house. She's mine.
Yeah, my house, right. My thing. My. That's brutal. Mm-hmm. But she's my house. She's my horse. She's my everything. Like, that's much. It's always she is. Which I think is, as an actor, a wonderful tool at your disposal. But also as an audience member, that's much more interesting. That he's not saying, like, just what you're saying. She's not this piece of property. She's saying she is all of these things to me.
She's my world.
Yeah. And in a world where, and we've seen people get, you know, this whole idea of arranging marriages based on dowries and contracts is not radical in this world.
Right.
And he's like, it's not about that. This is about her and I.
Mm-hmm.
Which has got to be revolutionary for her, I think, in that moment to see all these people that she rebels against, who don't take her quite so seriously, who are scared of her.
Right.
To see someone else put them down. And
right.
And he's like, this is me and you, Kate.
Right. That's someone says, literally, I will fight you.
Yeah.
Quick question.
Yeah.
What does buckler mean?
I think buckler is to shield. It's like a shield.
Mm,
or I'll shield.
Right. So, they shall not touch thee, Kate. I'll buckler thee against a million means I will fight a million dudes.
Yeah. Bro. I will protect you. No one can get to you anymore. No one can mess with you.
Mm-hmm.
Let me be the one that freaks out. I got this. Which I think it's a goosebumpy moment.
Yeah, and the fact that she goes without saying anything can be played, like, does he, if you want to be, you know, the boring choice is that she's, like, you know, crying, or, like, he has to carry or drag her off by the hair like a caveman, but she just agrees, if she agrees to go.
Yeah.
And right, like you said, they become a team, that the two of them versus all these idiots.
Right.
That's an interesting choice.
Right. Or to go even the other way, she drags him out. Like, let's get out of here.
Mm.
You know,
yeah.
Even take it to, like, okay, let's get it on.
Okay.
You know, I mean, there could be that moment of completely, this, you know, you got to find, one of the challenges in this show, in any show, I guess, is finding where's the moment that this all becomes real.
Right.
Or where do they fall in love?
Right.
It probably doesn't happen here, but maybe it does. You know,
or at least there's something. This is a moment in their relationship that needs to be played.
A moment of transformation, perhaps.
Oh, very nice. So there you go. I'll buckler thee against a million. The line from The Taming of the Shrew. Here we will highlight the biggest practical challenge to the director in this play and share a few ideas on how it has been solved in the past. For The Taming of the Shrew, I think the biggest challenge is the stage direction, Induction 1, which precedes Act 1, Scene 1. So just for a little cut, we kind of touched on this before, but this whole Christopher Sly framing device that Shakespeare uses, that there's this guy that these people in the bar are messing with, and then we'll tell him he's a lord, we'll treat him like a lord, and then we're going to put the play on for him, and the play is The Taming of the Shrew. It's a tough one to pull off.
It is.
You know, because you end up, Sly shows back up later for a brief pop-in.
Yeah.
So you have this actor who's now an audience member.
Yeah.
That starts the play. So if you don't know anything about the play, it starts with this, you know, the first 5 minutes of the play basically have nothing to do with the rest of the play.
Right.
However, if you cut them, then the play has no context and it can turn into watch this awful guy dehumanize a woman for 2 hours.
Right.
If you don't use this as a framing device. So right. How the heck do you do that, Dan?
This is a real challenge. I think this is much more, at first, it doesn't seem like quite a challenge compared to some of the other things you have to do, like bringing a harpy through a table.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, this is an emotional challenge,
because mm-hmm.
you're changing the tone of the entire evening for the audience, for yourselves, for your actors. a shout out to Seven Sages regular Kyle Milner. We were doing a reading of this in a living room several years ago in preparation before we were even auditioning to do the production. And reading the induction had been cut that evening. And you know, he was like, but without the induction, this play is a tragedy. And that comment really stuck with me.
Hmm, like, that's interesting.
It is, because it's sort of the same. It's the Comedy Tonight theory from
A Funny Thing
Happened. Yeah. Which is like, don't worry. This is a play. Don't forget, this is a play. We're in a play.
Right.
And the other thing, is, as a contract guy, you'll appreciate this. You can have, this is like, if you just cast Sly and the Lords as people who are on stage the whole time,
mm-hmm.
that's five actors we have to pay for like 4 minutes work, and then sitting on stage watching the play.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't double cast them, which is a solution. So the solutions are double cast,
cut,
or cast. And I've seen two of the three. I've never actually seen this cut. I've always been lucky enough to see the induction.
Oh, interesting.
But I saw a production at Theater for New Audience, and I think they cast it. Sly was on stage the whole time, and it was like sitting in a box.
It's a nice gig. It's a real plum gig.
Right? So he was just there, and it was a nice, at times he would look out at the audience and watch us watch. But it was a nice, that whole meta theater part of this play that we didn't talk on too much. Mm-hmm. Sly is a constant reminder of, hey, we're always in a play,
mm-hmm.
Which is one solution.
Yeah. And then, in the Seven Stages production that Dan was talking about earlier, you also, as Petruchio, you also played Sly.
As Sly, I played Petruchio.
Okay, sure.
But yeah, Sly got ripped into the play.
Mm-hmm.
And then we did, our director, Andrew Cutaspati, did a great job of making the induction. It was so stylized. The style of the induction was hyper theatrical,
mm-hmm.
so that when we got into the play actually became realism.
Mm-hmm.
And then the world that Sly lived in was not a real world,
mm-hmm.
Until the end. Cause Andrew brought back from Taming of a Shrew.
Right. That work by Anonymous.
There's a button at the very end of the play where the widow or the innkeeper comes out and finds Sly asleep, mm-hmm. on the ground, and he's basically like, I've had the most weird dream. which helped blur those lines between, is Petruchio Sly, is Sly Petruchio?
Yeah.
You know, we didn't ever really seek to answer that question in this, mm-hmm. production, but it was definitely there that, like, maybe Petruchio and Kate don't work out quite so well, and in 10 years,
oh,
this guy's passed out drunk in the middle of the street, well, dreaming about his ex-wife.
The other idea I came across in preparing for this was, you know, in the original company, when it was all men playing the roles, right. Sly could have doubled with Kate.
Ah, interesting.
So he starts as this drunk, I mean, it would have been a kid,
right.
playing like a fall down drunk who then comes back as the shrew.
Oh, cool.
And so Sly is just like, that actor is just ready to rumble for the whole show.
Oh, that's fun.
But there you go. So that's a couple of ideas on how to handle the induction. So tweet at us and let us know how they handled it when you go to see the production that you're on your way to now.
Yeah.
If you found this helpful, please subscribe, rate, and review us on iTunes so we can keep bringing Shakespeare to your headphones on a weekly basis. If you have any questions or comments you'd like to send our way, you can email us at noholdsbarredpodcast@gmail.com. You can tweet us at NoHoldsBarredCast, or you can Facebook us at facebook.com/NoHoldsBarredCast. Until next time, I'm Kevin Condardo.
And I'm Dan Bollier.
'Twas I won the wager, though you hit the white.
And being a winner, God give you good night.
Adieu, adieu, adieu. Adieu, adieu.